So welcome to your first class on Civilisation Britannique pour Mef 1. Now, I know that you've learned a lot of British history, and when I looked back in the programme for the licence, I saw that some of you have done these. I know that not everybody has done everything, because these were options. Do you recognise some of these? Who did the class on Wales? What is Wales? Okay. Who did the class on 19th century political and intellectual debates? Yeah, it sounds hard, doesn't it? Yeah, okay. Who did the class on Canada's Aboriginal peoples? Yeah, was it good? Yeah. Was this Cécile Lefouache? Star. Okay, so I know you have forgotten quite a lot of this. And also, sometimes you know a lot about patchy things, and so I'm going to try to bring some of them together. This is the book which I recommend. I've already recommended it, but this is really, it is the best book. It has a lot of chapters. It's quite long to read. It will take you time. It has a lot of chapters. It has about 50 short chapters. I wrote two of them, one on Catholics in Britain and one on popular music in Britain. Catholic popular music? There must be a link. That really is the one. There are two or three copies in the library. Don't hesitate, it's not cheap, so don't hesitate if that's a problem. Try your bibliothèque municipale. Ils le commanderont, ils adorent quand on demande de commander des livres dans les bibliothèques municipales. Okay. I'm going to begin with Roman Britain, and here is a documentary which I recommend on YouTube. I'm always going to recommend a documentary, Toute l'histoire de la Grande-Bretagne romaine. Now, there are a lot of documentaries on YouTube. Some of them are very good, and some of them are really very bad. Yeah, this is why I recommend them. So, of course, the first thing to remember that is important in British history from the beginning is this old, that Britain is an island, of course. L'Angleterre n'est pas une île, but la Grande-Bretagne, si. And this has advantages and disadvantages. The advantages, it's quite difficult to invade. Much more difficult than France, for example. And indeed, the last time that Britain was invaded was in 1066. We've had no invasion since 1066. And some people think this has a psychological effect on British people. Maybe it does. I don't know. The second big effect of geography is you're never very far from the sea. Now, of course, this is nice because you can go to the seaside and sunbathe. Well, not really in Britain. But that's not the main point. The main point is that when the Industrial Revolution was just beginning, it was not very complicated to build canals so you could get to the sea from everywhere. And one of the advantages of Britain, which became the first industrialized nation, which is a tremendous advantage, and indeed, if you go back into the 19th century, who built the railways in Argentina? Who built the railways in India? British engineers everywhere, because they were the only ones, yeah? So to be first is a real advantage, and I think the geography helped there a little. Now, if we go right back... What the fuck? Sorry, excuse my French. If we go right back, the oldest part of the oldest signs of civilization in Britain are things like Stonehenge. And I was supposed to have written here exactly how old it is, but I haven't. So there you go. I'm not sure if it's 7,000 or 5,000 years ago. Pretty impressive. One of the impressive things about it is we know where the stones came from. The stones came from 200 miles away. And moving these stones, 200 miles, it's very, very impressive. And they've done a lot of work to try to find out how they moved the stones, but more important for a historian, because all historians prefer questions which begin with why. And so this is, why did they move the stones? There were plenty of stones locally. It seems probable that the stones were already holy, sacred, ritual, magical. And so they were moved because they were precious stones. Of course, this is just a ruin. It was a complete circle. It was a complete circle at the beginning. I might even have that. The next well-known civilization in Britain is what we call the Beaker civilization, and we call it the Beaker civilization because they made this is their typical pottery. But I'm just going to wade through that very quickly. Followed by the Celts. Oh, I know. Ha ha ha. It was on the other side. Yes. Followed by the Celts. And here you have an example of Celtic drinking halls. The Celts arrived. I will tell you exactly when. So 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, Stonehenge. Around 4,300 years ago, the Beaker folk, and around 700 before Christ, the Celts. And this is just an example of something that they knew how to do, and they still know how to do, which is to drink. This is drinking cones. So we get to the Romans when you get the attempts to, that's also Celtic from the British Museum. By 50 BC, you have the Celts in Britain, but you mustn't imagine it as some sort of unified Celtic nation. In fact, it's a large number of different tribes, and here are just some of the names. You don't need to know the names, but the important thing is that there is a big division there. Now, the Roman Empire depended on expansion. It could only survive by expanding militarily. And the method was that the Roman method was very interesting. They would invade a territory, co-opt the elites, give all the privileges of Roman citizenship to the elites, and get lots of taxes back. The centre of this is taxes. And one of the main reasons that the Romans never conquered Sub-Saharan Africa and never conquered Scotland is because the nature of the land meant that you couldn't grow enough to pay enough taxes to pay the army that was needed to occupy. It's very, 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 very. So, I mean, the Scottish are very proud that the Romans never successfully invaded Scotland. But the real reason is there are too many mountains and you can't grow enough. You can't make enough money to pay the army. I mean, the Scottish were certainly pretty brave as well. So those are the two attempts which did not work. Caesar began in 55 BC. He had a little go, but didn't manage it there. 55-54. It gained a little bit of progress in Kent, but didn't get very far. And Augustus in 27 BC got a little way, and the British resistance managed to put them away. So finally, the successful. Am I still doing this right? Aha! Finally, the successful invasion is in 44 AD. That's right. And by 50 AD, this is the situation you have in Britain, where there is part of Britain around Colchester, which is directly controlled from Rome, and then another part, which is, if you give us money, we won't invade you. Direct control, yeah. So it's a good way of, if you're ever invading a country, I recommend this method. Now, on the one hand, as I say, there was tremendous advances in Roman civilization. For the people who lived in the towns, there were temples, there were baths, there was running water, incredible things. There were games and celebrations and relative peace. Remember that previously the chiefs would walk around with their weapon on them and not for decoration. Yeah? And so the Roman peace was in towns to have a more pacified society. However, it was also an extremely cruel civilization. And although this is not a real photograph of a real gladiator, Nevertheless, the gladiators were something very, very real. For example, at the time, the rich people would organise big games. I'm organising the games for prestige. And on the invitation, it would say, "Please come to my games. 50 slaves will die." And the other, last year I had my games and 100 slaves died. That's better. So it really was pretty bloody and pretty horrible in many ways. Here is the Circus Maximus. Now this one is at Rome, in Rome, but they had similar ones in Britain. This is enormous games, and they were also very, very inventive about it. They had elephants fighting against seals fighting bears. Seals fighting bears, not seals. So how do you say this? Des phoques contre des ours. Bien sûr, plus de phoques. But it's different. It's different. Now the gladiators, of course, didn't have a great time. They often died before they were 30 years old. One of the more famous ones, Flamma, had 34 fights and he won 21 times. But each time he lost, he was popular enough to be saved. So you know, if you look at the whole situation, it's better to be a student in Rouen than a gladiator. Good choice there. Now, of course, the slaves would regularly, there they are. It's only a drawing. It's not a drawing from the time. Now, of course, the slaves would sometimes revolt. It was extremely difficult to revolt. But one of the more famous revolts was the one led by Spartacus, and this is at 72 before Jesus Christ, and he was very successful against the Roman armies until, of course, he finally lost. And when he'd finished and they lost, they took a stretch of about 100 kilometers of road, and they hung a slave every 100 meters. Because they wanted to give the impression that it was a good idea not to revolt. Okay, so that would convince me. That would definitely convince me. But back to Britain then, changes in the direct Roman control of Britain, and they aimed at converting the warrior chiefs of the British into Roman gentlemen landlords. The old tribal districts became local government districts, temples were built, piazzas and baths. The public buildings were very lavish indeed. And there was a tremendous... It's important to note that at the time, the people who live in towns in Roman Britain are kind of parasites. All the wealth is made in the countryside. Agriculture is the only wealth. There's no significant industry. So in the town are leisure places to eat the taxes which are brought from the countryside. So it's very different from later on in modern capitalist Britain or elsewhere, where most of the wealth is made in the towns, and indeed often it's necessary to subsidise agriculture to make sure that there's enough to eat. Roman Britain had a huge amount of trade, and the amphorae which they find can help them very much to understand what was happening, because they are made in slightly different ways with slightly different material. And so when they find some of these, recently they found some in the south of England, and they can analyse this, this one was made in Tunisia, but this one was made in Italy. And so really there was a lot more trade than you think. Of course it was very slow. If you went from London to Rome, it would take you weeks. Not just because you only have a horse, but also because there were very few roads. So it's very tremendously slow. They built villas. The rich people, of course, built villas, and the villa has a section for the slaves and so on. And they invented this idea of the family. Now, the family is not the modern meaning at all. The family is everybody who lives in the villa, slaves, property, animals, and so on and so forth. And we saw one of the signs of riches in a Roman villa is a mosaic. They're extremely expensive to make. I think you can understand here, because they didn't have machines to make them. And so this was really a sign that, you know, you've got a mosaic. It doesn't really work anymore. You know, let me tell you, if you see the mosaic my mother bought me for Christmas, it doesn't really work like that anymore. There were some revolts against the Romans. Boadicea, sometimes called these days Boudica, in 61 AD. We say BC for before Christ and AD for after Christ. AD Anno Domini is Latin, the year of our Lord. I know that in je sais qu'en français on a commencé à dire avant notre ère, après notre ère, pour ne pas dire le mot Christ au cas où la police laïque vienne. In English it's before Christ and AD. Nobody, in fact, BC and AD. I think people have even forgotten the meaning. Just BC, yeah. But it is before Christ. So the revolts by Boudica of the tribes against the Romans, they were quite close to winning. And of course, what's interesting about it is that you have a woman military leader, and we have the reason we know this is that some of the Roman writers wrote about the fight. So this is Tacitus. On the opposite shore stood the Britons, close embodied and prepared for action. Women were seen running through the ranks in wild disorder, their hair loose to the wind. The Druids were ranged in order with hands uplifted, invoking the gods. The novelty of the fight struck the Romans with awe and terror. Now, of course, he's making a good story out of it, but nevertheless, this was a real fight. And indeed, the Romans did not succeed in conquering the whole of Britain. From AD 44 to AD 78, there was a war in the West. A confederation of local chieftains in Wales was joined by some defeated chiefs from the southeast of England. The Romans were very interested in Wales because there was gold, silver, lead, and copper. So because of the hills of Wales, the agriculture was not so interesting, but gold, silver, lead, and copper were obviously things that were very, very interesting. Everywhere in Europe, I already mentioned, the Roman Empire stopped along the plough line. That is to say, if you arrived in a country where you couldn't plough the fields because there were too many mountains or too much desert or too much forest, the Romans couldn't go any further because they couldn't pay the army. Let's have a look at the north. There was a war in the north from AD 69 to 142. They kept moving forwards and backwards. 40,000 soldiers were needed to defeat Scotland. But they had a problem because Rome was being attacked, and so they had to bring soldiers back for that. Now, when I say that in Scotland the land was not rich enough to pay the taxes to pay the army, this is what historians have calculated. The Roman emperors didn't necessarily understand that. Hadrian in 117 decided to change tactics. He said, let's not expand anymore. Let's reinforce the borders. And in Scotland, this is Hadrian's Wall. It's still there today. I was there a month ago, and this was the frontiers were reconstructed in stone. And they moved. They got further north and then came back and got further north and came back for 300 years. Hadrian's Wall. One of the interesting things about Hadrian's Wall, it was built by three different regiments of Romans, and they each had their own style. And you can see how they made it differently in different areas. Nevertheless, further south in Britain was relatively peaceful. And according to Gibbons, who is the great historian writing of the Roman Empire, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. This is a long time. This Edward Gibbons, I think it's 19th century. It's really, really old. The Golden Age, in his opinion, was 150 to 225. Lots of roads, lots of mosaics, lots of frescoes. However, remember, I keep saying remember, but you don't know, but let me tell you, most people were not allowed to use the roads. You could use the roads if you bought a permit, yeah? So we mustn't idealise the situation. There was some economic progress. For example, at the beginning of the second century, they drained the fenlands around in the east. This is land which was much too wet to use, and they used technology to drain the water away and to reclaim land. So this is the sign of an expanding economy. And the Roman state also organised gold mining in South Wales and lead mining in Derbyshire. A huge army, 40,000 men, and villages of traders and retired soldiers around the army. Most of the population were small and medium peasants, and they made enough to eat most years, but not every year, and enough to pay the taxes. They probably had to pay 10% of their output in taxes, and also had to do forced labour. That is, three days a month you must work on the roads because the Romans said so. There were at least 1,000 country villas. We need to remember also that the population is much smaller today, and they were getting grander, but it was the beginning of the end. By the time we get to the 3rd century, I think this is the 3rd century, and you can see that they have to divide Britain into two to administer it. Meantime, in Rome, things are going very bad. Caracalla, the Roman, killed his brother to become emperor, and then was killed by another member of his family. This is normally a sign that things are not going too well. And then the Roman army on the Rhine murdered the emperor, and then the next emperor was murdered by his own soldiers. In the space of 50 years, there were 40 Roman emperors. So yeah, this is the crisis of Rome, and Britain was reorganized. There was an interesting revolt in Rome, lovely revolt, I love this. Carausius is the name of the gentleman involved. He revolted against Rome and seized the control of northern Britain. But he had a special idea. He told everybody, I am joint emperor. We have the emperor in Rome, and I'm also the emperor here. We're joint emperors. He was making it up, yeah, but nobody thought to check their Facebook, you know. So that's why it worked. And so he had success. And here you can see, because this is the coins which he produced, and indeed his coins were actually better quality, more silver than the official Roman coin. So he was a rebel emperor, if you like, pretending to be emperor. Of course, they sent a new emperor along and defeated him. So, in general, the Roman Empire is having great difficulty. There are attacks on Rome. It's impossible to expand anymore because they've reached the plough line. But expansion was the centre of the Roman Empire's dynamism. And so they had a difficulty, and Constantine had a new idea. He had a fabulous new idea. Now, in fact, Constantine was chosen as emperor by the British army and imposed through without really following the rules. But in any case, he was emperor. He became emperor in 306. And he had a new idea. He said, instead of fighting against these Christians, why don't we make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire? Now, okay, the Christians had a really good story. It's a fabulous story of the Bible. I mean, you couldn't make it up. Well, they did make it up, but you couldn't make it up about this idea that, life is pretty hard, but you'll be okay when you're dead. Number two, you feel like everything's your fault, but it's not your fault because it doesn't have to be your fault anymore because Jesus died for you. And remember, I'm talking about other people's religion, not about yours. So it's a great story. So why did he choose? Remember, we historians, we only like questions which begin why. Why would he choose to stop killing the Christians and make them the official religion of the Roman Empire? Well, number one, the church people could read and write. That was quite good. That was quite a good idea. But I think the main thing that it was one universal religion could bring sectors of the empire back together. Monotheism, the idea that there's only one God. Remember, the Romans had plenty of gods, and the Celts had even more. So, we've got 12 gods. Oh, we've got 13. You know, the idea of only one God is a symbol of the unity of humanity's purpose. It's the symbol, you know, that we don't. There aren't. We can understand and control the world with the help of our one God. Whereas when you have many gods, it's, well, this God wants this, and this God wants that, and this God, they're fighting each other. And so it's a symbol of life being difficult to understand and difficult to control. And so the advantage of monotheism, and secondly, the advantage of church intellectuals and a powerful ideological machine. The Christians were very determined, and they went around telling people, yeah, come and join. And when they said, come and join Christianity, after Constantine, they were saying, come and join Christianity and support the Roman Empire. As you know, even today, the Catholic Church has its world capital in Rome. We still have that heritage. You know, Rome, which has declined in many other ways. And indeed, the Vatican is a country. It's an independent country in the middle of it. It's an amazing success story in many, many ways. So Constantine ordered the dissolution of all the pagan temples. All the money and gold in the pagan temples will go to the church. And the church, the clergy, the priests and monks do not have to pay taxes. The new villas which were built with Christian chapels. A lot of people who previously persecuted Christians joined the church. Hey, you know, like times change. You know, it happens in politics with political parties. You know, when it's on the rise. So it was a good time to be a Christian. Christians are no longer executed. For example, it's always nice not to be executed in the morning. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to Agen, but in Agen, the cathedral is the Cathedrale de Saint Capré, who was executed in 303. So he just missed it, yeah. 10 years later, and he would have been given a lot of money. Poor old Capré. One of the ways that we can see that Christianity is on the rise is looking at the mosaics. Remember, mosaics are only possessed by rich people. If you're poor, you don't get no mosaic. And here is a mosaic, and what you see for the first time in this period is the Christian symbol. In fact, it's Greek letters. It's a rho and an X, and it means the beginning and the end, or it's something really Christian. So, in fact, we can. The problem, of course, is we have very few written documents from the time, in particular, few written documents and even fewer objective written documents. So the number of mosaics with Christian symbols is one of the ways that we know that, you know, it worked among the things. So urban paganism declined, the temples were no longer renewed, and we were tremendously lucky because at Water Newton, somewhere in Britain, they discovered, I think 50 years ago, a hoard of Christian treasures from the 3rd century. So they got a lot of information like that. As I say, most of what we know about the 3rd and 4th century in Britain comes from archaeology, and not from reading, and not from reading documents. The towns declined slowly, and there were no new buildings. Fundamentally, there were no new buildings. By 410, this is the situation that we have in Roman Britain, and you can see some of the important places there. For example, Eboracum in the north, which is York. Names always tell you a lot about places. York, that doesn't sound the same, because Londinium, London, it sounds the same. Eboracum, York, sounds differently because anybody know where the name York comes from? What civilization? It's the Vikings. Yeah, the Vikings, which is after, you know, get the order right, after which take it. But quite a few places are already known by their modern names. Glavan is Gloucester, a Londinium, of course. Well, not so many, in fact. Not so many have names which resemble their... Lindum, Lincoln. Tamboricum, Cambridge. So these are some of the important places there. This is 410, and the year 410 is our often the reference for the end of Roman Britain. In that year, the Roman emperor replied to a request for assistance from the Roman army in Britain, saying, sorry, we can't send you anywhere. The year before, the Britons had decided to expel Roman magistrates from their cities. That is to say, a section of the local elite, realizing that Rome was getting weaker and weaker, became more determined to do their own thing, but it all worked for a little while. Now, by 383, the Romans no longer rule the west and the north, and very, very slowly then. And we usually say 410. As the end of the Roman Empire in Britain. Of course, it's not a precise, precise date. Now, a lot of the people in the Roman armies, when Rome withdrew a lot of troops to Rome, a lot of people stayed because it was home. But that was the end there. Now, what do we have finally? The Roman warriors, quite advanced technology. The chain mail is pretty good for that. One of the last Roman rulers of Britain, Magnus Maximus. It's something which is very useful, coins. If you find a lot of coins with this emperor and not many with this emperor, it is often because the emperor with a lot of coins had a stronger economy and so on. Counting coins is what archaeologists do a lot of. And it was 1975 when they discovered the Walter Newton hoard, and this is one of the cups they discovered. The earliest Christian silver yet found in the Roman Empire. This cup is part of a hoard of silver vessels and plaques, which forms the earliest group of Christian liturgical silver. This is for use in the Mass, communion thingy. Although this cup resembles later Christian chalices, we cannot be sure. However, many of the objects in the hoard bear the monogram with the letters Chi and Rho, the first two letters of Christ's name. There you go, the first two letters of Christ's name. There was another hoard. This is from the Hosni hoard. A hoard. This is Hoard. And trésor, as you will. So this is another one. And so every time we discover a new, the archaeologists find a new thing, that we learn lots of new facts about it. Okay, I told you it was quick. That's Roman Britain. Okay, and so let's go through another few centuries. And I'm going to start this again.